I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
So, dear listener, you think you know the Functional Nerds just because you've listened to almost every episode nearly halfway through? Well, this is Matthew Sanborn Smith, and I am about to lay down the functional cosmology behind the show. The truth is, nerd culture was Patrick's and John's absolute last choice for a podcast subject. They originally wanted to do a show where they drank booze and screamed at one another called the Dysfunctional Nerds. Once they sobered up, they tried a podcast about Swiss Army knives called the Multifunctional Nerds. For a short while after the Swiss Army beat themselves senseless, they became the Malfunctioning Nerds. Then they tried to get down as the Parliament Funkadelic Nerds, but alas, they couldn't get down because their sparkly silver platform boots raised them into the stratosphere. For about a day and a half after John taught a particularly exciting math class, they became the Function Nerds and discussed the mathematical relation between a set of inputs and a set of permissible outputs with the property that each input is related to exactly one output. It was going to be crazy. Luckily for you, they went with what they know and became the Functional Nerds, which is about to start, so let me shut up. By the way, if you don't like this one, let them know. Waiting in the wings is the Functional Curds, their incredible cottage cheese podcast. I'm kind of hoping that you make that one happen. Shh, shh. Here comes the non-dairy version.
My name is Puddin'Tane. Ask me again, I'll tell you the same. His name is Charlie Brown. Ask him again, I'll knock you down. And you're listening to episode number 168 of the Functional Nerds Podcast. Now with 63.278% more rhyming.
Wow, that's very good. That is actually Patrick Hester.
John never knows what I'm going to say, and he's always thrown.
I'm always thrown every single time. He is an author, a blogger, and a podcast dude, also a Hugo winner. And you can check out his website, atfmb.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at atfmb. I am a composer and a songwriter, and you can check out my music over at johnanilio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at johnanilio. And this week, this is another Just the Two of Us episode. We enjoyed the last time we did this so much that we do want to do this from time to time, just so Patrick and I can sort of catch up a little bit. And, well, we like talking a lot, so sometimes it's nice to not have a guest and just sort of be able to talk about the things that we kind of feel like talking about that week.
Well, so, and I got an email from someone who said they really enjoyed the last one.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's always nice to hear that.
Well, you know what's funny is I saw someone tweet about this the other day too. They were talking about the Dragon Page podcast, which was Michael Stackpole and Michael R. Menengay, and that was probably the first sort of genre fiction podcast, or one of them at least, because I remember listening to that years ago. And I guess they're kind of done. Like they haven't done an episode, like, because someone tweeted like, oh, they haven't made a show in a year now, or whenever it was. But I remember when I used to listen to that show, I used to love when it was just the two of them. I didn't necessarily like the interviews that much. I liked when it was the two of them talking about it. And I remember at the time, again, this is going back 5, 6, maybe more years ago. And I remember Michael Stackpole would really talk a lot about ebooks, like he was like very pro, and this is before they really took off, and he was just sort of like, this is where everything's going to be. And for someone like Stackpole, who has a lot, see, he's sort of like Mike Resnick in terms of a very prolific author, has a lot out there, a lot of his stuff had gone out of print, so for him ebooks were a gold mine, because he was able to take his books that were out of print, put them up on his website, and have a whole new revenue stream. So he talks a lot about that back in the day, and I imagine he's still like that. And I also came across sort of along the same lines, an article that Kevin J. Anderson wrote sort of about the future of ebooks, and how for him, same deal, like very prolific, has a lot of stuff out there. And the fact that the thing that Anderson was talking about in his blog post was that now his stuff is available everywhere. Mm-hmm. Whereas it used to be, you know, you would go to, you know, certain Asian countries or something like that, and they got the books, if it was physical books, they got them so much later, and they didn't really have like a typical bookstore. It would just, if they got lucky, maybe they would find it in like a market or something somewhere. And now, you know, he has all these Asian fans, for instance, that when he puts a new book out, they can just get it. And it's a different world. And especially if you're someone like Kevin J. Anderson, who has written so much and written all the tie-ins and all the Star Wars books and all that, and has a big fan base, you know, it's a big deal to be able to just sort of get this stuff out there.
Well, but. and I think he actually, he did something a little bit different than Resnick. Kevin actually has, his own imprint that he uses to push out his, I think it's, is it Mindspring or Mind?
Is it Mindfire?
Mindfire or Wordfire?
Wordfire?
It's fire something. No. Fire, yeah. Fire. Yeah, fire. It's some sort of, it might be Wordfire now that I think about
yeah.
it. But to basically push his stuff out that way and get some of his other stuff. Now, there was an interesting article, since we're talking about this. Christine Catherine Rush on The Business Rush had recently a piece about how a lot of publishing companies are sending their authors addendums to their contracts. Especially contracts that were pre-ebook that are trying to get back like ebook rights to books that they did not originally get the rights to. And part of that is they are trying to redefine what it means to be out of print. Mm-hmm. It used to be, you know, when your book was out of print, the rights reverted back to you. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't an immediate thing. You know, there's a little bit of time. You know, the book goes out of print and, you know, after X amount of months or something, you know, the rights revert back to you. That's how Resnick and Anderson have all these books coming back to them. And Christine Catherine Rush as well. You know, she's got a lot of books coming back to her now. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to redefine what it means to be out of print. And part of it was something along the lines of out of print doesn't really mean out of print. And now the publisher has, you know, if it, basically out of print means that it's not available for sale on the publisher's website.
Okay.
So if the publisher is still selling it as an ebook or something like that on the website, it's still considered in print, even though it's not a physical book anymore. And if they take it down from the website, they have 6 months to, quote unquote, fix the problem. So they can take it down for 5 months, not be selling it, and then put it back up on the sixth month, and it's still considered in print. So that's just one of the things that's kind of out there that they're playing with, you know, trying to figure out this whole ebook stuff. One thing that Christine does point out is that you don't have to sign those addendums if you get them. And she recommends that you don't sign that kind of addendum if you get it, because, you know, then you'll never get the rights back to your book. There's some weirdness going on out there. And it just comes back down to what we have talked about on this show quite a bit is ebooks took publishers by surprise. Mm-hmm. They weren't quite prepared for it. And so they're catching up, and a lot of them have caught up and are doing some good stuff now. Some mm-hmm. of them are still on the fringe trying to figure out, you know, what's the best way to do this. What was the other thing I was going to tell you about ebooks? I've completely lost it.
Well, you know, if you think of it, you can interrupt me, but I was thinking about it a lot, and I read another post by Scott Lynch where he was talking about, he'll get fans that will email him and say, when I buy your new book, where should I buy it? What's going to be most beneficial to you? Mm. You know, meaning like how much, you know, where do you make the most money from? What's going to help? And he wrote a great post about this where he talked about, look, you buy it wherever it makes most sense for you. If you want to buy an ebook from Amazon, buy an ebook from Amazon. He's like, I want you to enjoy my books. And if it means I get a couple extra pennies, if you do it another way, that's not worth it for me. I don't want you to do that. I want you to enjoy it as much as you can, which is why, you know, the book one in my series, we've made available for $1.99. Because now I feel like with that first book, he's like, you know, I got a good advance for that. And it made its advance back before it was actually on sale. I guess it had like a lot of good word of mouth. He's like, so that book has continually made money with me for the past however many years that it's been out. He's like, so that book's job now is to get me new readers So that's why I'm so happy that they're putting it out there for $1.99, because I want them. I want new readers from that book. He's like, but if for my new book, if you really want to help, what you could do is go and buy the physical book, because that will get me on lists, like bestseller lists and things like that. And as weird as those lists are, they still mean something, and they still help you get – if you get on those lists, you get more readers. So if you really want to help me out, go and buy the physical book when the book comes out, because that's what it helps. But otherwise, buy whatever you want. And I thought it was a really cool article, basically saying, like, do what you want. But if you really want to help, you can do this, you know.
So, well, and there are things you can do. I mean, like on Amazon, you can like the book. Mm-hmm. That always helps, you know. And,
yeah.
And you can talk about the book. I mean, if you really enjoy somebody's book and you have a blog, why not write a blog post about it?
Right, right. And pricing of digital things is something that I've thought a lot, you know, and I don't know what to do about it anymore in terms of like my music, because I'm confused about everything now. I don't, you know, I have lots of thoughts about it, because I do make a lot of my stuff available for free, and I do charge for certain things. And I don't, going forward, I don't know how that changes or what to do, because there is this whole idea of like racing to the bottom. Meaning, you know, it's like, let's race to free. And then, well, okay. So if you're doing it and you're just sharing your art, I think that's fine. And I think that's the attitude I've taken with it. But I also kind of feel like, well, maybe I need to price things differently. And I guess we're all just learning like what works and what you should do. Because I know for me too, if I get an ebook for free, or if I have to pay, even if I have to pay only $2 for it, there is worth associated with it. And I'm kind of more likely to read something that I paid for. I'm definitely more likely to read something that I paid mm-hmm. for. Like I put value on it. But so where's the line? Where, you know, I don't know. That's
well, and two things for you on that. Number one, Publishers Weekly just put out an article wherein Simon & Schuster admits that production costs for ebooks are far less and below production costs for physical books. Therefore, they're making more money off of the ebooks.
Of course. Yeah.
So that's one of the first times I've seen a publisher actually admit that.
Yeah.
Most of the time they tell me I'm stupid and I'm insane and that ebooks cost way more than physical books to produce, which is just utter and total bullshit. The second thing is that did you see the interview with David Byrne from Talking Heads?
I saw one about him. It might not be the one that you're thinking of, because I saw one about him saying that you can't live in Manhattan anymore. So I don't know if that's
no, he was talking about how online access and streaming is destroying creativity.
Okay.
Go look that up.
Okay, I will. That's interesting.
Yeah, I thought that might be right up your
way. Yeah, yeah, I will definitely go and check that out. But yeah, so I don't know. That's thoughts on ebooks. So,
well, which we weren't even planning on talking about.
No, there you go. Well, let's get to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And I will go first this week. I read and I tweeted about this, and it was very funny, or people thought it was funny. I read a biography about Yngwie Malmsteen. I bought a biography about Yngwie Malmsteen. And for those of you who do not know, but I think Patrick and I have actually talked about Yngwie Malmsteen uh-huh. on other occasions. Yngwie Malmsteen is a guitar player from Sweden. And in the 80s, he kind of broke on the scene and never really achieved mainstream popularity. If you were a guitar player, you knew who he was. He plays with incredible speed and precision, and has this, you know, he's a metal guitar player, but he sort of takes a lot of his harmonic ideas from classical music. So it basically sounds like Bach and Paganini, but played really fast on a Stratocaster, really loud. Yngwie Malmsteen is also a ridiculous figure because, and I think Patrick actually went to the G3 show
yep.
with Joe Satriani, Steve Vai, and Yngwie Malmsteen. Yngwie Malmsteen is known for wearing still his leather pants and boots and pirate shirts and the whole thing. And at this point, I think he's slimmed down again.
He's not a small guy.
No, he at the time, I think he's in a little better shape than he was then, because at one point he got very puffy. He was like sort of this thin, as Swede in the 80s and then kind of blew up a little bit, but was still holding on to the leather pants, and it was kind of ridiculous. So I am very aware of his ridiculousness, but you cannot deny.
Yeah, like, for a little while there at that concert, I thought I was going to get a completely different show.
Yeah. But I've always been a fan of his guitar playing, and I've always known that he's been a jerk too. Like, if you were a guitar magazine reader, even if someone was praising him, it just always came out that he was a jerk, because he was great, but he knew he was great, and he kind of bossed people around. And so when I saw this biography, I was just really compelled to read it. And it's written by a Swedish music journalist, so it's translated, so it's not the best book in the world. It's called As Above, So Below is the name of the book, but it's translated into English, and it's a little awkward read at points, but I found it to be quite fascinating in terms of learning about. Now, funny enough, Yngwie Malmsteen also wrote an autobiography that came out at about the same time. I have not read that one yet. I figured the biography would be a bit more accurate to hear an outsider's point of view on his life, and he just led this like really crazy wild life, and you know, typical rock star stuff, got into all the drugs and the booze and got into a car accident and just all sorts of crazy crap. But just a really kind of intriguing, compelling figure. And I still like his music. Not all of his music is great, but a lot of it is really good. And I'll recommend the book, and I'll also recommend one of his albums. He's put out a lot of albums. If you go to Spotify, he's got a billion albums and fairly consistent. But my favorite Yngwie Malmsteen album is called Odyssey, and it has Jolynn Turner singing on it. And it's sort of a bit 80s metal-ish, but like really good songs and really amazing guitar playing. And I think you would dig it. And if you have time, put Yngwie Malmsteen, and it's spelled Y-N-G-W-I-E, but you say Yngwie. But Y-N-G-W-I-E, put Yngwie Malmsteen into YouTube and find the clip of him. He has this thing called the, Concerto for Electric Guitar and Orchestra. And it's actually really good, but he's performing it live in Japan with the Japanese, with like the Tokyo Symphony Orchestra. And as Patrick pointed out, Yngwie's, he's kind of a big dude, but he's also like tall too. He's like 6'3" or 6'4". Yeah. And so he's playing with this Japanese orchestra, and they're kind of small and very sort of, I don't know, timid, I guess. And so they are there, and they do a little opening number, just the orchestra by themselves. And then Yngwie walks out, leather pants, leather boots, pirate shirt with the super puffy sleeves, like a big jacket, Stratocaster, and he's loud. And he just, but so to see Yngwie just sort of like looking at the Japanese conductor, who I think Yngwie is taller than the Japanese conductor, even though the Japanese conductor is on the conducting podium and Yngwie is not. But just to see him like ripping on guitar and in his ridiculous outfit with the Japanese orchestra sawing away, it is just for comedic effect, that is worth looking up. So Yngwie Malmsteen is my pick this week. Patrick, how about you? Yeah.
Well, you know, there's all this advice out there for writers and authors. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they do say is, if you're not writing, you should be reading. And don't just read within your genre or the, mm-hmm. you know, the genre that you like to write, or read other stuff. You know, just read as much as you possibly can and take from that cumulative knowledge what you can to make your stuff better. With that in mind, I know this is a little bit late, but we lost Tom Clancy.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that not everyone's going to agree with the politics that go into his books. And there's nothing I could do about that. Mm-hmm. It comes from the characters and everything started in the Cold War. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's the Reagan era Cold War kind of stuff. And that's what informed all of his stories. So you have to take that with a grain of salt. But what I want to suggest, my pick this week, is that you go back and you read some of those Tom Clancy novels. And I'm going to suggest a couple. The Hunt for Red October. That's mm-hmm. kind of what launched everything, because you know they made the movie with
Alec Baldwin and
Fred Dalton, and Fred Dalton Thompson was in it as well. You know, Russians don't take a piss without a plan, son. You know, that kind of stuff. Yeah, great movie. You Parushke. Great movie, better book, obviously. You know, books are always better because they can do more. But that is a great book. That was the first one of his that I read, and I really enjoyed it. After that, read Patriot Games. Patriot Games to me is just this fantastic novel. I read it years and years and years ago. It's still to this day one of my favorites. I would actually put it above The Hunt for Red October, just in my personal favorites.
And I love Patriot Games as a movie too. I think that's a great movie too.
It was a very good movie. Yes, but if you've seen the movie, you know what happens to his family.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say that when I read it in the book, it hit me 10 times harder than that scene in the movie. It was like a kick in the gut.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because of what happens and his daughter is in the hospital and all. I mean, it's if you want to write scenes that grip your reader and make them feel what you want, that is a great scene to read and to draw from. So that's one of the reasons why I really like Patriot Games as a novel. The other one that I would recommend is a book called Without Remorse. And so you have the Jack Ryan novels, and those are the Hunt for Red October, Patriot Games, Clear and Present Danger, Cardinal of the Kremlin. You know, some of these are going to be dated. If you go back and read, like, for example, Cardinal of the Kremlin, that's got a lot to do with Russia and the Cold War. If you go to Without Remorse, there is a character called Clark, who is throughout the books. I think he only appeared in the Clear and Present Danger movie. And he was played by William Dafoe. They did not do him any justice at all in that movie. That movie was a horrible movie to begin with. They did so much. And don't even get me started on the new Jack Ryan movie. That just is pissing me off. Because it has nothing to do with any of the books. It's just, hey, let's take this character. And I'm betting that they had a Die Hard script that Bruce Willis wasn't available to do. So they decided to make it a Jack Ryan movie instead. Anyway. Without Remorse is the story of Clark and how he comes back from Vietnam and all this stuff happens to him. And it's about, he gets involved with a woman who is on the fringe of drugs and prostitution and all this kind of stuff, and bad things happen. And he uses his skills that he learned in Vietnam to solve the problem. And in doing so, has to become the guy that we know later on in the CIA books, in the Jack Ryan books. It's a very intense book. I don't know that he wrote many books about the side characters in those novels. And Clark, you know, he kind of grows over time in those books and comes to do a lot of different things with Jack. But Without Remorse, definitely worth your time. So those are my three picks that I think people should go out and read. The Hunt for Red October, Patriot Games, and Without Remorse.
Cool. Very good. Very good.
It's almost like I thought about my pick and made a choice this month. My God, what's wrong with me?
You didn't pick fried chicken this week. Okay. So let's get on to our main topic this week. And I actually really wanted to talk about Twitter. Early on in the podcast, or in our podcasts, I should say, we talked a lot about social media and we've sort of haven't talked directly about it in a long time.
We talked about it so much that when we went to World Fantasy, Blake Charlton introduced us as the social media gurus.
Oh, that's right. I recall that.
Everybody that we met.
Right, which was sort of hilarious considering there was, like, you know, a lot of big-time authors like Scalzi and everybody there who had, like, you know, 20 times the followers. Yet. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But no, you're right. We did talk about it a lot. Yeah, and the point is that we haven't talked about it in a very long time, and I think we've all been comfortable not talking about it. But it's been on my mind a little bit lately, and I think it's because, and I can only speak about my personal experiences with social media, but I find I want different things out of social media now than I did in the past. I think for a long time for me. I'll admit it. Like, I wanted a lot of followers. Like, I wanted as many people following me as possible. Like, my whole sort of this theory behind it, or my whole plan was, you know, just try to get as many people following you as possible. And you
clobbered me in the super secret war of the functional nerds.
Oh yeah, I forgot we used to talk about that. Yeah, so I had, you know. Anyway, so the point is, like, I really wanted to have a lot of followers, because I guess my whole theory was, well, you know, then when you put your music out there or whatever it is you do, then that's more people that can find out about what you do. And I was never a buy my stuff, buy my album. Like, if you do follow me on Twitter, you'll see that I do talk about my stuff and I do put links to my music, but you generally, and it's more than this, but I at least use the 80-20 rule where I talk about other people's stuff 80% of the time. And I don't even think I talk about my stuff 20% of the time at this point. I put stuff in there for my stuff, but really it's always links to other blog posts or book reviews, or because I just think that's if you're like, when you talk to people in real life, you don't talk about your own stuff all the time. You ask them about what they're doing and you talk about other people's stuff that you like. So you anyway, I engage, yeah. So that's the way that I've always approached it. And that's the way I still approach it. However, I am starting to get to the point where I still want to have a lot of followers. I still want to have a community and an audience for sure. Absolutely. But Twitter had gotten to the point for me for the past few years where basically the way I approached it is I use that Buffer app and I tweet out stuff throughout the day because I do have a job. I can't be on Twitter all the time. So that's sort of my way to sort of poke my head out even when I'm working. And then when I have lunch or other times of the day, I'll check in and I'll sort of reply to people who replied to whatever my post was. And I have to say, I tried to keep up with my stream as much as possible. And I used to make different groups and lists to follow people, because basically my point is I followed a lot of people back. I followed almost everybody back that followed me. And that's, you know, sort of changed over the past couple of years, where I slowly started not following everybody back. And I used to follow a lot of people because I wanted them to follow me back too. So that was initially how I, you know, built up the amount of people that followed me. And well, now, so I got to the point where I was following well over 1,000 people. I have about 2,500 followers right now. And as of today, I have about 1,300 people that I follow. And I kind of think that's still too many, because I look at my list and I look at that stream and I'm trying to get my stream to where my stream is engaging and is useful and is not Patrick's about to make a pee joke.
I didn't say a word. I didn't say a word, but you knew you could see it in my eyes.
I saw it in your eyes. Yeah. No, because I would totally make it.
I held back.
I appreciate it. But no, you know, I used to always make groups. You know, I would make groups of people. And I got to the point where that was too hard to keep up with, because you'd want to add people to the group and then maybe you'd want to take people out of the group. And so I'm just like, you know what? I want the people I follow to be the people that I follow. I want to engage with those people. So recently I've just been unfollowing a lot of people because I followed so many in the beginning. There are many people that I've never interacted with. I've never replied to them. They've never replied to me. I think a lot of people had the same mentality I did a few years ago, where it was like, oh, you follow people and they follow you back, and that's how you build up a following. And I just realized, like, I'm less concerned about how many people follow me than I am about the quality of the interactions. I want to get more out of Twitter now. And I've noticed I've probably unfollowed a couple hundred people in the last few weeks. And I find Twitter to be a hell of a lot more fun and useful now, because I know the people that I see, whether I've either met them in person or they're just someone I interact with a lot. So they're who I want to see. And, you know, so it's, and I will say this, if you're somebody who is following me, who I was following and I unfollowed, and we have had a relationship, like, just, you know, reply me back and I'll follow you again. I basically unfollow the people that I think that we don't ever talk, ever. I don't even remember who this person is. Maybe we talked 3 years ago about something and haven't since then. I'm not doing it as like a snub. I just want to make my Twitter feed more useful, more entertaining. And so that's what I'm doing. So that's the way I'm sort of approaching it. I'm trying to make Twitter more useful, basically. So that's my thoughts on it. I mean, I don't know how you, because I know you weren't one, Patrick, to follow everybody back, even back in the day. Nope. So I imagine now, I don't know if you use groups, because I know you follow a decent number of people. It's not like you follow 20 people. You follow a good chunk of people too. So how do you manage your Twitter stream, and you know, what are your feelings about this kind of stuff?
So there's a couple things. Number one, I religiously used TweetDeck.
Mm-hmm.
TweetDeck was my go-to for social media because it took care of the two big ones. It took care of Twitter and it took care of Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I can have them all. And I use the desktop app. Mm-hmm. I dislike with a fiery passion that I cannot emphasize enough Twitter.com and Facebook.com. Mm-hmm. I hate having to access them on their own websites because they control everything, and it's just a pain in the ass. I don't like the way that either website works. I like the services that they provide. I hate their websites. Mm-hmm. So TweetDeck for me was the bomb. I mean, it was it. Once I landed on TweetDeck, I was the happiest camper in all of Camperville. And TweetDeck has so Twitter bought TweetDeck. And immediately started stripping out all the stuff that I loved about it to make it more in line with what they wanted you to have from Twitter. They want to control the experience that you have with Twitter. And so they stripped out a bunch of stuff. They changed up their own Twitter app, their own desktop client, you know, that kind of stuff. Because I actually had TweetDeck on my phone and on my computer.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the columns. I liked that I could have who I follow in one column, my all of my interactions in another column, my direct messages in a column, who is new and following me, what's going on in Facebook. And then, yes, I had lists. And I would have my lists in other columns, and I would, you know, see who's doing what. And that way, you know, if I missed something in the mainstream, I could jump over and see what's going on in my list of, say, Colorado authors, or my list of publishers, or my list of indie authors, or, you know, any of the lists that I had going at the time. So TweetDeck, huge. Twitter buys it, and they pulled a General Electric on me. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean that I worked for a manufacturer that was a competitor for General Electric. General Electric could not, you know, openly destroy them. So what they did was they bought them. Mm-hmm. They loaded them up with all kinds of crap, and then they sold them and pulled the rug out from under and destroyed that manufacturer. And that's kind of what Twitter did with TweetDeck.
Right.
They bought it. They nerfed it. They tore the guts out. And so I didn't even upgrade for a long, long time. I had people like Jame Gates actually upgraded and was so upset that she was hunting for people who had an old version that she could install on her computer, for example. So right. I never did the updates. I kept my TweetDeck as is. Well, they finally pulled the plug on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they said they're not going to support it, and it's going to stop working on this date. You have to move to the web-based version.
Yeah.
Again, I hate the web-based version. I do not like it. I don't like doing that kind of stuff in a browser.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather have a desktop app. So that's kind of that has informed my entire experience here lately. I switched to something called GenEditor.
Okay.
And it gives me the columns, but it doesn't give me all the columns, and it doesn't do Facebook. So that's what I'm using right now for Twitter. So my Twitter experience has been halved.
Mm-hmm.
I am still, Twitter is still my go-to social media. That's the one I love the most. I'm doing more with Facebook, as you probably maybe noticed.
I have, yeah.
It's interesting. Google Plus is still out there. There are people who have embraced it, and they do a lot of stuff on Google Plus. I'm not one of them.
Me neither.
WordPress only recently added Google Plus functionality. Like in the last upgrade about 2 weeks ago, they added Google Plus functionality to the Jetpack plugin. So it's the first time that I've seen Google Plus. When Google Plus came out, I would search for plugins for Google Plus, and I never saw them. That doesn't mean they didn't exist. I just never found them.
Google's been very protective of their API with that, because I use Buffer, and I would use Google Plus more, but you can't use Buffer with Google Plus. Now you can do it if you have like a business page. But if you have just like a regular account, you can't use Buffer still. So I'm not going to take the time to hand post everything. I sometimes put stuff on Google Plus, but I barely use it. And it's a shame because I loved Google Plus when it came out. I thought, oh, this is great. This is going to replace Facebook. Great. And
and it hasn't.
I think a lot of that is Google's fault because they didn't let other third parties really – they didn't open it up to other third parties to do stuff with it. And if they, I know for me, I would have used, like, simply if they let Buffer play with Google Plus, I would use Google Plus because my Buffer would go there too. And I would probably check it anytime anybody interacted with it. I would be in there. And then that's the thing. Like once I'm there, then I'm probably going to look around and look around at other people's stuff. But I don't think to go there that much. And I know a lot of people still do use it, but you know, I check Twitter and I check Facebook and, you know, and they're two different animals, Twitter and Facebook, you know, because Twitter, I post a lot more on Twitter because Twitter is a stream and I don't think anybody tries to check, you know, hours worth or a day's worth of, I think if you follow any more than like a handful of people, and most Twitter users follow at least a couple hundred people, if not a couple thousand people. So it's really real time. You know, yeah. I open up the stream, I maybe look back time wise, maybe I'll look back a half hour. I don't think I ever look back further than an hour in the stream. I'm not going to look that far back.
Well, and it can be strange when someone replies to something that you posted a couple days ago and you're going, what's this reply about?
Yeah, well,
you kind of have to think about it for a second.
Well, you can always check that, and that's the thing. It's like I always check my replies, and I always reply back to everybody that replies to me. But in terms of looking at my stream, I never go back further than an hour, ever. It's real time. Whereas Facebook, and I put different sorts of comments and or I should say like posts and links on Facebook because I know that lasts a lot longer. If you post something that a lot of people like, it just keeps showing up in more people's feed and it'll last for a while. And a lot of times what people like is kind of silly stuff. You could just post like something kind of funny or whatever. And, sure. You know, if 20 people like it, then it shows up in a lot more people's feed. And then the next thing you know, your 20 people is 40 people liking it. And now there's 10 comments. And so you get more in, you kind of can get more engagement on Facebook depending on the kind of things that you post. But I kind of like the real time of Twitter though. I like that, you know, so we're recording this on a day when New York Comic Con is going on and I'm not there. But I'm seeing all the New York Comic Con tweets and I like it. I like seeing the pictures from Comic Con and I like, you know, I enjoy that. And, you know, you'll see that at Facebook, but it's just a little different. But I think, and I've seen a lot of, you know, different people writing about this and I got to thinking about this even more, and which is why I wanted to use it as a topic because I saw someone write a post about Twitter with this and that is sort of Twitter's problem is that when people follow too many people, it sort of hobbles it. It makes it less useful because if you look at your streaming, you just see tons of retweets and tons of stuff that you're not interested in. You get snowblind and you don't see anything then. Right. And what I thought this person made an interesting suggestion, you know, Twitter has that, you know, who to follow thing in the sidebar. You know, they were saying what Twitter really should do is also include a who to unfollow, meaning, and I know that sounds kind of crazy, but it kind of makes sense to me. It's like, meaning, you've never interacted with this person ever. He's never replied to you. You never replied to him. Do you really want to follow him? Why don't you cut him loose? And I think, yeah, that's not a bad idea.
Well, and to go to your original question, as of this recording, I follow 2,076 people. And or that's how many people are following me. I'm sorry.
Right.
And I follow 1,100.
Right.
My rule has always been to try to keep it under 1,000. So I'm about 140 over that right now, because it does get to become unmanageable. As you said, I've never auto followed anybody in my life.
Mm-hmm.
If I follow somebody and within seconds of my following them, I get a direct message from them that says, hey, thanks for the follow. Check out my blah, 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 blah at this link.
Yeah.
I unfollow them.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Because that's not a person I want to talk to.
No.
Because they've just basically pissed me off and mm-hmm. you know, you piss me off, you're done. Mm-hmm. And so I always vet people. I look at them. Mm-hmm. I look at their feed, you know, before I decide to follow them, especially if they're interacting with me. If you're interacting with me and you're making me laugh, I'm going to follow you.
Yeah, that's just the way I can look at it now, too. Yeah.
If I'm looking at your stuff and all you're saying is, hey, check out my link. Hey, check out link. Check this mm-hmm. out link. There's a link for you. You know, I'm not going to follow you. That's boring. It's not going to work for me. Mm-hmm. So that's always been my philosophy. Twitter is still my go-to social media. It's still the one that I like the most because I can come on at night after work and it's like hanging out with my friends again at mm-hmm. WorldCon. You know, I could see all the people that I haven't talked to. Now, like you, my jobs have always been a little bit different. I've been able to tweet at work before because I'm part of my job as a marketing director is to do social media. And when mm-hmm. I had TweetDeck, TweetDeck allowed you to do multiple accounts.
Right.
So mm-hmm. I could be doing work stuff and I could still be following my stuff at the same time, all in one interface. If I mm-hmm. want to do that now, I have to go like Hootsuite or something and I have to pay for it, which right. kind of sucks. So right now I'm not doing any social media at work for myself. Mm-hmm. I post in the morning. Mm-hmm. I post when I take a break or I'm at lunch and I'll have some things scheduled throughout the day, but for the most part, I'm not doing it. And there's a couple reasons why. Number one, I don't want to give my work my passwords.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you think the NSA is bad, your system administrator at your work on your network knows everything you do. So I don't want to give them my passwords. So that's why I never log in on work networks. The way I treat social media has changed,
mm-hmm.
Because I'm not doing it throughout the day. I'm not doing it as much as I, and the other thing, John, is we'll have people on the show. Like we recently had Steven on and we had Wesley. We've had different folks on. And what happens is a lot of times you are friends with them on Twitter, but I might not be yet.
Mm-hmm.
And after a show, I'll follow them. They'll follow me. And I'm not saying that this is Steven and Wesley. I'm just using them as examples. They just came on. I've been following Wesley since WorldCon. So, but what I always find funny is I can go on Twitter rants, which means I can, you know, Ancient Aliens is on or there's something going on and I will just, you know, tweet for like an hour nonstop. And it always amuses me that when we have people on the show and I follow them and they follow me and then I go on one of those rants, they no longer follow me because they're like, this guy's filling up my Twitter stream. I don't want him anymore. And then there's also the people who love that kind of shit. So, but hey, at least I'm not a bot.
Right. Exactly. Well, you know, and you were speaking about how you tried to keep who you were following to under 1,000.
Yes.
And that is sort of what I'm looking towards. I'm at about 1,300 right now, and I'm trying to that's kind of what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to weed it down to 1,000 if I can. Because I think it used to be where number of followers were important, but what I've realized when I sort of, like you were saying, you'll go and check out if someone follows you or whatever, or just someone who comes up, you'll go and sort of check them out. And I notice I don't care about the number of followers because I see people.
No, I don't care about followers. I just care about interaction.
Right. Well, I care about interaction, obviously, but really, I also am sort of struck by the ratio, like how many they're following versus how many followers, because I see some people that have 50,000 followers but are following 50,000. And so it's like, well, that doesn't really mean anything.
Right.
So I think for a long time, my followers and they were almost even. And I realized, like, all right, so if I have 1,500 people following me and I'm following 1,500, what does that really mean? So I'd much rather have less people following me but have a higher percentage because I think people look at that. I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I look at it. So
you want quality instead of quantity, where before you wanted quantity and then you were going to delve down to quality.
Yeah, so now I'm sort of like looking at it the other way, and really more than anything else, what I'm getting at is like I just want to kind of have fun on Twitter again. And for a long time, I didn't really I barely checked my regular home feed because it was too much. It was overwhelming, and most of it wasn't things I was interested in. So now I'm looking at it, and I'm like, I know all these people, and this is fun again. So that's what I'm
And there's a telltale sign a lot of times with people who follow you. So for example, if you're suddenly followed by someone and you click on their profile, and they have a photograph of an extremely attractive young woman in sort of a selfie kind of portrait, you know that is not someone that you're going to interact with. That is some sort of porn spam bot. And after you stare at the photo for 10 minutes, go ahead and turn that person off. You don't have to follow them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well,
I've sort of instituted a new policy on Facebook.
Okay.
If you invite me to play stupid fucking game number 3, there's a 90% chance I'm going to block you.
Yeah.
Because I'm tired of it. Because I turn that crap off, and then Facebook changes stuff and turns it back on.
Mm-hmm.
If I have the control to turn it off, don't keep changing. It's like they keep moving the cheese or the prize or something. I don't know. You know, it's like Facebook's like, oh, all these people don't want to get these messages anymore. Well, we need to change the terms of service, and we'll see if maybe this time they'll actually like them.
Right.
I don't get it. I don't get it. It really pisses me off. Now, we've talked about this before as far as authors are concerned. I don't think you can be an author in today's world and not have a social media presence and not be doing some stuff. But you control it.
Yes.
It doesn't have to control you. You know, anybody listening to this, it's not – this isn't all in.
Yeah.
You know, pick the platform that you want to fart with that one. Don't let it control you. Don't let it overwhelm you. Don't let it distract you from the things that you're trying to get done and accomplished. You know, it needs to just be another tool, something that you use, you know, hang out with your friends. We had Stephen Blackmore on, and he was talking about the cards, you know, to get you back on track. Well, guess what? Twitter can do that too. Sometimes you can go on Twitter and say, hey, all my author friends, I'm having a really hard time with such and such and such and such. You know, any ideas? And you'd be surprised how many people will jump on and say, oh, well, here, look, you know, if you do this, 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 and this, it's great. The Twitter hive mind can be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And
I agree.
So that is something, it's a resource for you.
Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to get back to. I'm trying to get back to it just being that resource, being that thing that I enjoy, and I'm having a lot more fun on it these days. So everybody, go and unfollow like half the people that you follow.
But don't unfollow us because
not us. You know, oh no.
Yeah, no. We're good. You gotta keep following us.
Yeah. We spin pure gold on Twitter. Okay. All right. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. For me, for my music, it's johnanilio.com. You can follow me on Twitter at johnanilio. And it's gonna be a little bit away from this, but I haven't really had any shows booked for a long time. And I actually have a show coming up in December, so it's still going to be a while away, but it is going to be a holiday show. It's December 13th, and it is in Princeton, New Jersey, and it is with, I'm going to be doing about a 20-minute set, and there's going to be three other songwriters on there, and one is Sarah Donner, and if you recall that Sarah Donner was also on that show that where I played with Molly Lewis and the Double Clicks. So this is basically her show that I'm sort of going to be a part of, and I'm going to do all my Christmas Hanukkah songs. I'll be doing the Batman song and the Millennium Falcon song, and I really wanted to get on this bill because like I never really performed those songs, and those are kind of my most popular songs or amongst my most popular songs. So I'm very much looking forward to doing like a little 20-minute set of some sort of nerdy holiday music. So if you're in anywhere near Princeton, so Princeton's actually not that far from Philadelphia, so if you're down in that area and you want to come up, that would be great. So shoot me a line on Twitter, and I will give you the details about it. So that is December 13th. So, Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
Same old. Go to atfmb.com. You'll see all my stuff. I'm writing reviews for Kirkus on graphic novels. I recently did Gail Carriger's manga. I did Bad Island. There's all kinds of stuff over there. So, you know, go check that out. Wednesday Doodles, Friday Flicks, writing journals, all that kind of good stuff. SF Signal Podcast, still pushing out the live Worldcon interviews. Just good stuff. You know, I was thinking, John, I'm thinking about trying to figure out how many hours of podcasting I've actually done and recorded.
Whoa, that's a lot. Yeah. That is a lot. I don't know. I know just for functional nerds, like, I don't know. There are many gigabytes worth of files up on our box.net thing. Uh-huh. So it's, I think it's at least like 12 gigabytes or something like that.
But how many hours and minutes does that translate to? That's what I'm curious about.
I know for functional nerds, we're in year four and pretty much have done it every week for,
well, you know. And when we started, we used to do it a lot differently. We would record more than actually went on.
Oh yeah, that's true.
The show. Cause we would record, I would start recording as soon as we connected on the phone,
right.
Skype, and I would record until the end. And so that's how I used to do, if people remember, I used to do the little, bits at the end where it was like outtakes almost.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's because I was recording so much. So I was just, for some reason, I've been thinking about that lately.
Yeah. Thousands, maybe. I would say thousands, probably. At least in the hundreds, that's for sure. So very crazy. Good. Very, yeah. All right, everybody. So we will see you next time. Thanks for joining us, and have a great week.
Still here? It's over. Go home. Go.